Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past 3 weeks, ISIS has claimed responsibility for three attacks. Yesterday, the Russian government acknowledged that a bomb destroyed a Russian charter jet that crashed on October 31st in Egypt's Sinai Desert, killing all 224 people on board. The head of Russia's Federal Security Service said, quote, "We can definitely say that this was a terrorist attack," end quote. ISIS claimed responsibility, saying it was punishing Russia for its bombing campaign in Syria. And then on Thursday, ISIS claimed responsibility for a double suicide bombing on a working-class neighborhood in South Beirut, which left 43 people dead and 239 wounded. On Friday, terrorists hit Paris with a series of attacks, which killed at least 129 people. They have all been identified. In the aftermath of the Paris attacks, French President Francois Hollande called the atrocity an act of war and escalated its bombings of ISIS targets in Syria. So Syria is now being bombed by the U.S., Russia, and France. What is the end game here? If the war on terror is creating even more terror, what are real alternatives? And if American bombs cannot destroy ISIS inside Syria, what makes the French and Russian governments believe that more bombs are the answer? Who's really suffering here? One of today's guests, Samer Aboud, says the main question we need to be asking is, how can we stop the violence? Samer Aboud is an associate professor of historical and political studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania and author of the new book Syria, which provides an in-depth analysis of the multi-layered causes of the current political and military situation in Syria. Samer is an Ottawa-born Middle East expert. Most of his family is in Lebanon, but he also has family members in Damascus and Aleppo. They refuse to leave Syria. And Samer joins us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Samer. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me, Liz.
It's nice to have you. We're also joined by Chris Tenzing, Executive Director and Editor of Middle East Research and Information Project, a quarterly journal that provides in-depth information and analysis on the Middle East. And Chris joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Samer, I want to start off with you. We have been racking our brains over the last couple of days trying to figure out, you know, how to frame this show. I mean, what's really missing from the conversation? There's just so much debate about ISIS. And you say that the main question that we need to be asking, and that's really missing from a lot of the conversations, is how can we stop the violence?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the consequences of the bombings in Paris is that everyone's attention is now turned to the ISIS threat beyond Syrian and Iraqi borders, when in reality the largest threat that ISIS poses to civilians and to the world is precisely what's happening inside of Syria and Iraq. And so while the bombings in Sinai, Ankara, Beirut and Paris and elsewhere have been very problematic and expand the battlefield, the reality is that Syrians are living daily, you're living this reality and this horror on a daily basis. The question is, the questions that we're asking in the West are problematic because we're focused on solving one layer or one very minor part of the larger problem, and the larger problem is the instability and the violence that is occurring in Syria. Now, that itself is multi-layered and doesn't involve, as you suggested in the introduction, merely bombing ISIS out of existence. We know now that strategy simply isn't going to work.
Because your argument is that if you have the largest military in the world, the United States, the most powerful military, bombing ISIS, and it's not able to bomb them out of existence, what makes the French and Russian governments believe that more bombing is the answer?
Exactly. What we've seen in the last 12, 13, 14 months of American-led bombing, and even in the first period of the Russian intervention, is actually the front lines inside of Syria are not changing that much. Mm. I mean, they're changing a little bit here, a little bit there, but more or less the way in which the country began to fragment territorially in 2013 and into 2014 is beginning to consolidate. And that's why I think we need to be thinking about what is happening on the ground in Syria, how are the rebels or the different armed groups cooperating, when are they entering into conflict with one another, and to ask questions about how that situation can be de-escalated without the further intervention, which is simply putting more and more pressure on civilians.
And Chris, what do you think about this? What do you think about the question that Samer is posing, that how can we actually stop the violence and more bombing is not the answer?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't hear anything that Samer said. I'm not sure if there's a technical problem, but I certainly agree in principle that there is not a military solution to this, to the issue of ISIS, as has been pursued so far by either by the world powers like France and the United States, or by the regional powers, the states, the armies that surround the areas that ISIS controls. The real issue is what is the political endgame that would be brought about by some sort of attack on ISIS, assuming that the political will for that actually existed among any of the parties to the conflict. And that has to be not just the extinction of ISIS or removing ISIS as a factor, but actually making some headway in resolving the political conflicts that underlie the Syrian civil war and the proxy war that the Syrian civil war has become. I completely agree that the top priority is ending not just the violence that is perpetrated by ISIS and against the areas that ISIS controls, but also in Syria as a whole. There is the larger context of the Syrian civil war, which has absolutely devastated that country. The numbers are staggering beyond belief. You know, over half of the country, the country's population is displaced, either outside Syria's borders or inside. The death toll is enormous. Mm-hmm. Something has to be done. It's beyond urgent for not just Syria but also the neighboring states that are bearing the brunt of the refugee crisis that has resulted, to bring that war to an end.
Chris, if you need to get some water, please do. Samer, are you able to hear Chris?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that we fixed the problem. Hopefully, I'm sorry, Chris, if you couldn't hear Samer. So Samer, again, before we dive deep into this, some context. There are so many debates happening. Everybody's got an opinion about what should be done about this. What do you think is missing from the conversation, just in terms of the different players that are involved in what's happening now? And I know this is a huge question, but also how we got here. What do you think's missing in the conversations that you're hearing?
Well, what I think has happened in Syria is that the regional players have adopted the military solution. And this was very clear towards the end of 2011, the beginning of 2012. And from that point on, politics or any sort of political process never really had a chance. So whether the Geneva process or the Moscow process or any of these initiatives, other initiatives from the UN, whether the local ceasefires or anything like that, all of these have been doomed to failure. They've been dead on arrival, really. Everyone participates in them in the international community because they want to appear as if they're doing something and that they have some commitment to a political process, when in reality, what we've seen is the regional states, the ones who are, as Chris suggested, kind of fueling the proxy war, have devoted their resources to a military solution. Now, the problem is that what we've seen is the regime is strong enough to stick around. It's not strong enough to win, right? So even when Hezbollah entered and you had deepening Iranian involvement and now Russian intervention, none of this has given the regime the military upper hand. And on the other hand, the armed groups are being funded by so many different actors, so many different states, whether it's Qatar, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and there's facilitation of all these weapons coming in, but they're fighting with each other. That's number one. And the second point is that they're not strong enough to defeat the regime. And so you have this situation of kind of military balance. Everyone is strong enough to stick around, and nobody is strong enough to win. And the problem with that is that it doesn't exist, this kind of fight on the battlefield, this commitment to a military solution does not exist parallel to a political process. So when the Vienna summit happens, you know, recently. You see 13 countries coming together, and the idea is that you bring in the regional states and you have them begin to negotiate. Well, there's two major problems with this. First, there was no Syrian representation. How can we talk seriously about a political process that doesn't involve any Syrians? Not one Syrian. And the second problem with that is that the majority of the countries, if not all of them, have not demonstrated any commitment to multilateralism, that they seem more committed to fueling the military situation. And this means essentially that politics is dead. And so the challenge is to, I think, undermine the military solution as an option and to make politics possible again and to make politics relevant, because this conflict right now is not taking place on the negotiating table. It's taking place within Syria at the expense of Syrians.
Chris, are you able to hear Samer now?
Unfortunately, no, I still couldn't hear him.
All right, well, we're going to try to figure out what's happening on our end. Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of Historical and Political Studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania and author of the new book, Syria, which provides an in-depth analysis of the current political and military situation in Syria. Samer has family in Lebanon, also family in Damascus and Aleppo. He says they refuse to leave Syria, and we'll talk about that later in the show. Chris Tenzing is Executive Director and Editor of the Middle East Research and Information Project. That's a quarterly journal that provides in-depth information and analysis on the Middle East. And Chris, Samer was just talking about the regional and international players that were invited to a recent summit on Syria. And he wrote a piece in which he pointed out that 12 foreign ministers gathered around a negotiating table in Vienna discussing a resolution to the Syrian crisis. For years, Syrians have been victims of the violent interventions of the same regional states that are now telling them that they don't have the ability to decide their future because not one Syrian was involved in this summit. So, Chris, what is the role of regional and international players in this conflict?
Well, thus far, the role of regional international players has been to egg on the side in the Syrian civil war that they happen to back. And that's true of everyone, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Turkey or Iran or Russia or the United States. The United States, to pick on ourselves first, has had somewhat confused and contradictory policy towards Syria since the 2001 popular uprising erupted. But it can basically be summarized now as saying from one side of our mouth that Assad must go, so encouraging the various elements of the Syrian opposition to wage a military struggle in the hopes that some kind of Libya-style Western intervention led by the U.S. is in the cards. In fact, that has never been in the cards and probably still is not. so that was a false hope that the U.S. planted in the Syrian opposition. And the main political effect of that on the ground was to encourage the Syrian opposition, which needed little encouragement probably in this direction anyway, that they would not lay down their arms or talk about a negotiated solution with the regime of Bashar al-Assad or the circles that surround him. In other words, that that Assad had to go in some shape or form before there could even be negotiations. And that's one of the reasons why the Syrians no Syrians were present at this international conference. And the dynamics on the other side are the same, and that has been the main effect so far of the Russian stepped-up military intervention to bomb Syria. It has greatly stiffened the resolve of the regime to keep fighting itself until it achieves military advantages on the battlefield that will make it stronger at the negotiating table in the future. So, and I suspect that the intensified French bombing is going to have the same sort of effect on the conflict as a whole. So, so far, even though the U.S. and others are mouthing all the right words about, you know, there's no military solution, it's only a political one, all of these slogans that we are familiar with now, the actions on the ground and in the skies have very much belied and been betrayed by and betrayed, I should say, that rhetoric, and betrayed the Syrian people, who are the primary victims of ISIS as well, as of the regime and the dynamics of the Syrian civil war.
Chris Tenzin is executive director and editor of the Middle East Research and Information Project, and Samer Aboud is associate professor of historical and political studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania and author of the new book, Syria. We decided to wait until today to do a show about ISIS because we wanted to see what conversations were happening, what the debate sounded like. And Samer and Chris both say that the question we need to ask is, how do you stop the violence? If American bombs cannot destroy ISIS, what makes the French and Russian governments believe that more bombs are the answer? What are your thoughts on that? What do you think about the debates that you're hearing in the media? And if the war on terror, quote, war on terror, is actually creating more terror, and it is, what are the alternatives? Are you hearing any alternatives from the people that are being interviewed in the media and the conversations that you're hearing? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Igel in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I was listening to your show, and I just wanted to ask Samer Aboud a question. I mean, I hear what he's saying, and I understand that, you know, politics is dead, and I understand that bombs are not the answer. But what I'd like to ask him is, what does he think that this so-called Islamic State wants? Do they want to sit at the table with all the other countries and go to summits and explain their way of life and how to do things in a calm and diplomatic way in politics? Does he think that that's what they want? Because I know, and most of the world knows today, that's not what they want. I'm from Paris. I have many people affected by what happened. These people are not people we can talk with. Politics doesn't work with these people, with that so-called Islamic State. So instead of all these beautiful, dreamy ideas of stopping the violence in these ways that he's not explained yet, I'd like to ask him what he thinks needs to be done.
No, that's actually a very good question, I'm sorry, I believe I was perhaps a little bit misunderstood. When I was talking about reviving politics, I wasn't referring to ISIS kind of coming to the negotiating table. I actually agree with the caller that this is not something that I think we can expect ISIS representatives to partake in. I mean, this is it's a no-brainer that they wouldn't show up to negotiate, or that they would be invited, or that they should participate. My fundamental belief is this, that ISIS does not have a future in Syria, it doesn't have a future in Iraq, it doesn't have a future in the region. But in order to ensure that that is what the next generation looks like, what the future does hold, you have to solve the Syrian conflict. You have to begin to bring the main actors together within Syria to negotiate a political solution. So I did not mean to suggest that the revival of politics would mean the inclusion of ISIS in a political process. No, absolutely not, because, I mean, they wouldn't want to anyways. But what it means is that you have to kind of go to the source of the problem. You don't amputate somebody's foot if they've broken their elbow, and this is what the bombing campaign has basically done. It's attacking the conflict in a very particular way that is not solving the problem. Sorry,
Chris, can you now hear Samer?
Yes, I heard.
Okay, great. Yeah. And before we talk about what ISIS wants, how would you also respond to Igel's question?
Well, I mean, I agree with what Samer said, and I think what. To answer the question of what ISIS itself wants, ISIS wants not just to what they call extinguish the gray zone, that is the zone of cultural contact between Muslims and Westerners and secular people and religious people and so on. They want to extinguish the very idea of normal politics that Samer is talking about. They want to create a world that is defined as a clash of civilizations, in which the only policy options that are conceivable and thus available to policymakers, whoever they may be, are military. That's what ISIS wants. And so the very act of refusing to respond in the way that they want, and instead seeking a negotiated solution among the parties that are sane and willing to to accept the idea of negotiations is a way of rejecting ISIS's worldview and a way of hastening the day, which I agree with Samer here too, hastening the day when ISIS is no longer relevant in the region.
And Samer, how would you respond to that question about what ISIS wants? What is its end game?
Yeah, I agree with, actually, I thought Chris articulated that very well. My general sense of what I could add to that is that I believe that to some degree chaos and instability is what they want. I mean, this now we're hearing reports, for example, of the passport, right? The faked, forged Syrian passport being thrown in, and a lot of analysis around how the attacks on refugees are precisely what ISIS wants to, as Chris said, to erase the gray zone, to erase the contact zone, and to push the world into these two camps, the good guys and the bad guys. And so I think that ultimately, the kind of longer-term goal is to divide the world into these two camps. That's consistent with their worldview. But in the meantime, I believe that the way they achieve that is the kind of chaos, instability, and fear that they're instilling in people, not just in Syria and Iraq, which is where they're based, but now within the region and into Europe.
Because it has been confirmed that passport was fake.
Yes.
And according to the Wall Street Journal, just a piece that ran yesterday, mystery deepened over a Paris attacker who traveled to Europe via Greece and the Balkans after French officials said Monday that the Syrian passport he had used was indeed a fake.
Yes.
Authorities in France and Greece have said fingerprints taken from the remains of a suicide bomber outside of France's national sports stadium match the prints of a man who entered Europe via the Aegean island of Leros on October 3rd. So it definitely was a fake.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Egal. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose and guests. One of the dynamics that appears to me not to be getting much attention anymore these days is the intra-religious war between the Sunnis and the Shiites. As I understand it, ISIS is a Sunni organization, and Iran is Shiite, and Syria is mostly Sunni. And we can't even get the Sunnis and the Shiites in Iraq together to fight a common enemy. So my question is, to what extent do your guests believe that the Sunni-Shiite problem continues to present an important issue that needs to be resolved to get to where we want to go?
Thank you, John. Samer, do you want to take that?
Sure. Thank you, John, for that question. I think that certainly the regional rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran is seen through the prism of this sectarian conflict, this larger sectarian conflict between Sunnis and Shia. And you even hear whispers in the region that, you know, we don't agree with ISIS, but at least they're defending a Sunni position. And we hear this kind of language, and you hear it on both sides, whether we're referring to Shia militias or Shia groups or Sunni groups or Sunni militias, that there is a sense that one of the larger problems of the region and one of the larger cleavages of the conflict is this broader Sunni-Shia divide, which I do think that many states in the region are beginning to see the conflict through that prism. I don't think that certainly it plays out in serious, significant ways inside of Syria. We've seen a rapid rise in sectarianism. You've seen essentially ethnic cleansing in some areas, and you have seen the conflict increasingly framed in sectarian terms. So I don't want to be willing away sectarianism or to pretend that it doesn't exist, but I think that what's happening on the ground is a bit more complicated. So, for example, many of the internally displaced people who are Sunnis, as John suggested, are going into areas that are lazily defined as pro-regime or Alawi regions, you know, along the coast, or Alawi-dominated, or things of that nature. I mean, Syrians of different sects are still living together. We know this on the coast, in Damascus, in other areas. That doesn't mean that mistrust doesn't exist between people. That doesn't mean that hatred doesn't exist. But I think that the reality on the ground doesn't fit neatly into the Sunni and Shia war, which I think doesn't really have, is a very kind of amorphous, strange conflict that manifests itself in Syria but doesn't really have an immediate solution to it.
Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of Historical and Political Studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania and author of the new book Syria. Chris Tenzin is Executive Director and Editor of the Middle East Research and Information Project. This is your call. We'll be back after this.
Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, if you'd like to join in today's conversation. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write your question or comment, you can send it to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. And following that, today at noon, Ira Glass and This American Life.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with NYU professor Erin Murphy about her new book, Inside the Cell, The Dark Side of Forensic DNA. We will discuss our unquestioned faith in DNA testing. She says that the same broken criminal justice system that created mass incarceration now has a new and powerful weapon. That is tomorrow on Friday. We will discuss media coverage of ISIS, and we'll also talk about media coverage of the refugee crisis. France has announced that it still plans to accept 30,000 refugees, while some American politicians say they want to ban them. That is on Friday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about ISIS, what are your thoughts on the conversations you're hearing, the debates that you are hearing? ISIS is now, Syria is now being bombed by the United States, Russia, and France. So what is the end game here? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of Historical and Political Studies at Arcadia University and author of the book Syria. He has family members in Damascus and Aleppo. Chris Tenzin is Executive Director and editor of the Middle East Research and Information Project. And let's hear from Martine in Bolinas. Hi, Martine. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for doing this. I wanted to mention a book by Michael Negler, who is author of Is There No Other Way? He was also a professor emeritus of classics and comparative literature at UC Berkeley and teaches courses in nonviolence and mediation, and one of the founders of the Mehta Institute for Peace. So this book really lays out how peace has worked in very violent situations. And I think it's a complex question that he addresses historically, and it's so important for those of us who are embracing the idea that there is another way to check this book out. And also, thank you so much for opening this forum up, because I'm happy to hear voices that are speaking up for peace in this. And one of the key differentiations, I'd like to say, vis-a-vis the needs of ISIS and so on, is let's differentiate between what their strategies are and their needs. Their strategies are tragic and violent. Underlying those are real human needs that we share with them. And so when we get to that other layer, I believe we'll be able to address this problem. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for calling in. Chris, what are your thoughts on this? And how do you bring this kind of conversation into the debates that we're hearing at a time when emotions are running high, tensions are running high? I mean, Igel just called in. He's from Paris. I mean, you could tell, you know, he lost so many friends. How do you bring this part of the conversation into that, saying that if the United States cannot bomb ISIS, what makes the French and Russian government believe that they can?
I certainly understand the sense of trauma and the anger that is felt by people in France and in Beirut and in Baghdad and in Nigeria and all of other places around the world where ISIS has or groups like them have claimed responsibility for mass atrocities. And we, of course, in this country, in the United States, we were victims of that as well on September 11th, 2001. And it's natural and understandable to have not just an angry but a vengeful sort of reaction. And the key, I'm an opponent of the death penalty, and I often think, in my capacity as a vocal opponent of the death penalty, people have often asked me, "What would you do if your father or your brother was killed, was murdered? What would you want to do to that person?" And my answer, when I've thought about it, has been, "I don't know what I would want to do to that person, but I'm glad the decision would not be mine." Because we live in a world of laws. We live in a country of laws. And that's the kind of world that we need to aspire to live in if we are ever going to break the cycle of violence and retaliation that has dominated so much of human history and that is so prominent in the news today. And it's not easy. It's hard. And I would never, be glib and imply that there's something wrong with people who disagree with me about this, because it's hard, and it's not been tried very often, right? So we don't have a whole lot of examples that can be adduced, but I would just say that it's very clear in the current situation in the Middle East that the war dynamics feed themselves, and the more that external actors put logs in the fire, they're just simply ensuring that the wars will burn hotter and longer, and so cause more just destruction and human suffering that none of us want to see. And so the imperative is to, at very least, stop putting logs in the fire, and also look for ways to turn down the temperature. And that's hard. It's not easy. It requires, in the case of the Syrian civil war, it requires talking to various sides of the conflict who hate each other with a passion and have profound human losses of their own that they are attempting to deal with. And so that is a tremendous feat of diplomacy that's required countries that actually have goodwill, and unfortunately, I haven't seen a whole lot of evidence that there is any country that has that level of goodwill that would be required.
Samer, what would you add to that?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that Chris's point about the war dynamics feeding the violence is spot on. I would add to that that there is an ideological and a material structure to ISIS. There is an ideological background to ISIS. There are doctrines within the region, specifically the Wahhabi doctrine, which ISIS's leadership prescribes to and is inspired by. And I think that, bombs can't undermine and delegitimize these kinds of doctrines, that there has to be a different kind of engagement or a different kind of confrontation. Another thing that I would add to that is just to remind everybody, remind myself and everyone who's listening, why the Arab uprisings began in the first place, is that there's tremendous inequality within the region. These are structural problems. There are structural problems embedded in the political and the economic architecture of the states of the region across the board, and this has bred inequality, it has bred exclusion, and it has fed the violence, if you will. It has fed the kinds of dissatisfactions and desperations that people in the region feel that compel them to commit acts of violence as ways to express themselves. That you know, the Arab uprisings, ISIS had nothing to do with them. Al-Qaeda had nothing to do with them. Islamists had nothing to do with them. These were uprisings of the marginalized, largely driven by the marginalized. And I think that if we can think of the problems as, or some of the issues in the region as being structural problems, the ways in which distribution, or like, you know, wealth is distributed, you know, break it down into questions, issues of jobs and employment and wealth distribution and things of that nature. I mean, even the World Bank last month came out with a report arguing for this very same thing. This is not an ideological position. It's something that I think for observers of the region should be quite obvious, that we're going right at ISIS with bombs and with this, and we're cutting off the refugees, but there's more to the iceberg. Right, there's more background to this, whether it's the ideological structure, whether it's the conditions of inequality in the region, and whether it's you know, the violence itself, which is a kind of magnet which pulls people in.
We actually have a caller on the issue of inequality. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The most recent issue of Foreign Affairs magazine has an excellent article about the possibility of creating economic zones in Jordan, which has an enormous number of refugees from Syria. And that could provide work, employment opportunities for Syrians who are outside of the country. And when the civil war is over, some of those jobs and those corporations or employment opportunities could go back into Syria. And I think the inequality issue has to be part of the solution, so that the younger adults who are going into ISIS have other opportunities and opportunities for a future in their own region.
Thank you for that, Samer. That's exactly what you were just talking about.
Yeah, that's a great point, Bill. Mm-hmm. I actually have that issue sitting on my desk from my neighbors. They told me to read it before they would. So thank you. I'll look that article up. Having not read it, and the idea of economic zones is interesting. I mean, I think that you what you need, and a good friend of mine and a very intelligent Syrian economist, Omar Dahi, has argued this before, that what you need to do is to kind of enhance development spending. You need development spending in the places where the refugees are. So I think that anything that enhances the development opportunities in those states could be beneficial for the refugees. My one concern, and again, I haven't read the article, my one concern is that in conversations around this that I have had personally with Syrians and privately and in public forums, is that there's this sense that what we really need to do is just create a bunch of sweatshops. You know, that's the language that they use. Just employ them and just do this. And I think that the transition from that kind of work or that kind of existence back into Syria is a bit more difficult than we may think. So that's not to say that we should just leave people living in Za'atari in the refugee camp and let them live in misery. I'm not advocating that at all. I just think we have to be a bit more sober in our assessment of what the outcomes of that kind of development spending could be. But I do think that any kind of programs that brings in money that can support people and provide them sustainable employment so that they could at least live with some dignity and at least have some money in their pocket or something, so that they could feel like, you know, that there's some hope for them. Mm-hmm. I certainly think that we can't. We should always encourage things like that.
Well, thank you for calling in, Bill. Today we are talking about ISIS. Syria is being bombed by the United States, Russia, and France. What is the end game here? What are real alternatives? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. How can we stop this violence? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of Historical and Political Studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania. He's author of the new book, Syria. He has family members in Damascus and Aleppo. Chris Tenzing is executive director and editor of the Middle East Research and Information Project. And we have an email from Ari, What about the people in the U.S. defense institutions who desperately want an opponent to spend billions of tax money to destroy? Donald Rumsfeld complained that there weren't enough targets in Afghanistan to validate dropping millions of bombs and missiles. We must keep the financial motivations behind endless global wars in these discussions. Wars never help poor people. Chris, what are your thoughts on this? It was just announced on Monday the Pentagon approved a $1.29 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia. 10,000 bombs, munitions, and weapons parts produced by Boeing and Raytheon. It includes bombs, laser-guided bombs, bunker busters. And then Al Arabiya and Samer has a piece coming out about this. Last month, Saudi Arabia and France signed a $12 billion arms deal. I mean, that's a massive arms deal. So, Chris, what do you think about these deals?
These deals are sending precisely the wrong signal to the peoples of the region who the United States claims to support in their aspirations for freedom and greater democracy in their countries. The Saudi royal family is not just the most undemocratic state actor in the region, but the most anti-democratic state actor, and their foreign policy since 2011 has been defined partly by, as I said earlier, an obsession with Iran, but also by, and I would argue more, by an obsession with trying to blunt the impact of the Arab uprisings of 2011 that unseated dictators in Tunisia and Egypt. And if they had been permitted to continue without such violent repression, largely funded by the Saudis in many places, might have threatened the Saudi royal family itself. So the United States and France, we spend a lot of time pointing our fingers at Putin and Russia and how he is propping up a dictator in Syria, and certainly Putin deserves a lot of criticism for that, and Russia is hardly a paragon of democracy itself. But we're doing the exact same thing, and that has been one of the pillars of our foreign policy in the Middle East since the Truman administration, to prop up friendly despots in the Arab world and elsewhere in the Middle East who happen to agree with our view of what U.S. interests in the region are and are willing to protect those interests in exchange for fancy toys like we're sending more to the Saudis. And by the way, a lot of those bombs are going to be dropped by the Saudis, the richest Arab country, on Yemen, the poorest Arab country, which it keeps falling out of the news. But the situation in Yemen is also breathtakingly dire, and the Saudis are fueling sectarian thinking. They are committing war crimes. They are dropping bombs on civilian areas. their opponents in the Yemeni conflict are no rose either. I'm glad that the Arab uprisings have been such a big part of this conversation, because ultimately, as well as, you know, economic inequality, the other thing that the peoples of the region badly want, and that was clearly part of the central demand of the uprisings, is freedom, bread freedom and social justice. And the persistence of authoritarian rule in the region, you know, exemplified by the Saudis, but also other regimes, is an enormous obstacle. Not just to freedom, but also to peace in the region, and to simple public safety. It's beyond hypocritical for the United States to claim to be spreading democracy in the world and to be selling arms to Saudi Arabia. It's just ludicrous, ludicrous.
And Samer, what do you think about this? Again, it's a $1.29 billion arms sale the Pentagon announced on Monday. And then last month, Saudi Arabia and France agreed to a $12 billion arms deal.
Yeah. Thank you, Ari, for pointing that out. I think that this poses a dilemma. And actually, Chris is totally right about this. If we want to attack the material and the ideological structures of ISIS, if we want to be serious about what that kind of confrontation would look like, then signing contracts worth tens of billions of dollars is not the way to start. Because what this does is it creates a kind of a dependence on Saudi Arabia. It enforces the Saudi position. And I would I would say that it puts us on the wrong side of history. And when I say us, I mean in the Western world. What it does is that it makes us complicit in the counter-revolution. And so for us to go around and say that we believe in freedom and democracy, when in reality what we're seeing is that the geopolitical interests of the West, and especially the United States, especially Europe, are basically focused on economic issues, economic cooperation. We saw this, when Sisi went to Germany and he signed the Siemens deal, and then all of a sudden German officials stopped saying anything bad about Egypt. The Saudis are buying arms in the billions, and so that has taken precedence. That is significantly more important than any real substantive support for democracy and freedom in the region. And so it puts us on the wrong side. It puts us on the side of the counter-revolution. And it's highly problematic, not just in the short term, but in the long term, because it is contributing to fueling the violence, not just in Syria and Iraq, but, thank you, Chris, for pointing that out, in Yemen as well. Mm-hmm.
And just quickly, Samer, what are your thoughts about Saudi Arabia? I was surprised that this didn't get more attention, but back in January, Senator Bob Graham held a press conference on Capitol Hill, pressing for the release of 28 redacted pages from the Senate report on the 9/11 attacks. And according to Senator Graham, the pages, quote, point a very strong finger at Saudi Arabia as the principal financier of the 9/11 hijackers, end quote. That really didn't get much attention in the media.
No, not at all. And I think this is the kind of primacy of geopolitics, that we see Saudi Arabia as the second most important ally, perhaps even the most, depending on the most important ally, depending on the day of the week. There are really substantive and long-term defense contracts that have been signed. There's, of course, the issue of oil. And I think that we have to be clear with ourselves that in the United States, that's the prism through which we see the region, through which we see Saudi Arabia, and anything that potentially disrupts that stability, that status quo, like something like the Arab uprisings, is a threat to American interests. So something like instability in Saudi Arabia, chaos in Saudi Arabia, threatens what the United States sees, I think, as the status quo, which for them is stable, and which we should also add is horrifically and violently unstable, as we're seeing, for the peoples of the region.
Mm. Chris, we have just a couple of minutes left. Where do you see this going from here?
Oh, boy. I don't know. My great fear is that the zone of the Middle East that is now controlled by ISIS and the surrounding areas, my great fear is that we're going to see a very long, protracted conflict there, which will ebb and flow, like the Lebanese Civil War did from 75 to 1990, and which will draw in various outside meddlers to varying degrees, depending on their calculation of their own interests at the time. People are saying that the Paris attacks are a game changer. I have not yet seen evidence that that's true. It looks, from France's own response, it looks like they're simply doubling down on the same failed, disastrous tactics that have contributed so heavily toward putting Syria in its current mess. So that's my fear. I don't know to what degree it's justified. There are a lot of unanswered questions. I did want to return. I didn't fully answer the question about the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. It was a Republican and a retired general, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who coined that term in his farewell address after leaving the White House. And, one searches the political landscape in vain, and I'm including Bernie Sanders in this, for a major American politician with the guts to point the finger squarely at this shadowy but very important actor in not just American affairs but also world affairs, and that is the Pentagon and the defense firms, which are, I think, properly viewed as, in many ways, a coordinated, if not unitary, actor that does have this very pressing interest in fueling war and conflict around the world so as to have customers for its products. And it's disturbing as well if you look at how much of the American economy, how many jobs are tied up with what we very euphemistically call the defense industry. Merchants of death would be a better term for it. And so this should be, this ought to be, again, if we're really serious in this country about saving our own democracy, let alone spreading it elsewhere, this really ought to be a major issue for certainly for progressive politicians. They really ought to put it on the table. We really need to have that debate.
And Samer, what would you add? Last week, the House and Senate overwhelmingly voted for the latest $607 billion defense budget, which includes a lot of money for Boeing. $607 billion. Just last week, it really didn't get much attention.
Yeah, I think Chris painted a pretty bleak picture about the current situation in the country, but I don't think that means that we shouldn't take aim at it. I think that Chris is right, that there should be tremendous pressure placed on the political system. If the politicians aren't going to do it, then this is something that we certainly have to be clear about in the conversations that we have about the Syrian conflict, about the Iraqi conflict, about violence in the world, in Paris and Ankara and Sinai and all of these places, and to begin to connect the dots and not to see the weapons that we export as somehow, just being put in some closet and stored away, that they're used against people and that they're used against entire communities and societies, and that these have long-term effects. And whether we want to believe it or not, that has an effect on us here in the United States.
Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of Historical and Political Studies at Arcadia University in Pennsylvania. He's author of the new book, Syria. He has family members in Damascus and Aleppo. Chris Tenzing is executive director and editor of the Middle East Research and Information Project, a quarterly journal that provides in-depth information and analysis on the Middle East. Samer and Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss our unquestioned faith in DNA testing. In her new book, Inside the Cell, The Dark Side of Forensic DNA, NYU professor Erin Murphy questions the widely held belief that forensic DNA is an infallible science. It has been a savior for over 300 men and women who've been exonerated, but she argues it has flaws. The same system that created mass incarceration now has a new weapon. What happens when DNA testing is used unwisely? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.